Welcome to another edition of the Unnamed Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock webinar with me. And thanks for joining me. And I have a few things I wanted to talk about, and then hopefully we'll have time for some questions. So the first thing, as always, there's some announcements, and I want to express my incredible gratitude for all the people who donated to the Stefan Lenka Fund to help support his research, disproving the fundamental basis of virology. And he had asked if we could somehow raise somewhere between $8,000 to $10,000, the best. And I can announce now that with all of your amazing participation, we have actually successfully raised over $10,000, which we will be sending to him when he lets us know. And that is a major victory on your part, not our part, because you were the ones who donated on our Subscribestar. And I know Stefan is also incredibly grateful and sends his thanks. And again, it's all, this is our research now. I remember talking to Stefan, and I used to refer to it as his research, and he kept correcting me and saying, this has now become our research. Not that I have anything to do with actual science, but I guess cheerleading counts for something. So that's the first thing. The other is we do have the COVID myths for tomorrow, Saturday at noon to 2 o'clock. I see the link in the chat. And I'm going to be continuing my quest into what in science is real and what isn't. And at some point, I may rephrase that and by saying, is there anything in science that's real? Because right now, it's hard to think of anything. Just to comment on that, because people say all the time, how is it possible, Tom, that they got so many things wrong? And in some ways, it's an interesting question. In some ways, it's not. But the way that it is the answer is because if you start with a certain framework, a certain assumption, a certain hypothesis, in this case, the hypothesis is that only physical matter exists. There is no creative, non-physical force in the universe that has any impact on biological systems. That is the fundamental assumption behind modern so-called Western science. If you make that erroneous assumption, every single thing you do after that will be incorrect because the assumption is incorrect. And then science becomes an endeavor, or science becomes an endeavor to prove your theories rather than to investigate and understand the truth. And that's how we got into this mess. So, the other thing that I've said a number of times since this last couple of years, and I'm going to give an example of that because somebody brought it up to me, was because I'm going to change to a little bit my view on the question of, is there a pandemic? And in fact, it was an interesting thing because when I was confronted by the reporter or somebody, I'm not sure, reporter, somebody from the BBC who was doing a story that I was part of, or he wanted me to be part of. He kept asking me the question because obviously he wanted to catch me in a soundbite that he could use against me. He kept asking me the question, is the pandemic real? And of course, I asked him to define what real is, and he refused to answer. But all along, I've been saying, you know, if you look at the death rate, you know, the death rate was a certain amount in certain cities or towns or countries or states or provinces in 2019. And then it went down. And there's an example from Germany. In 2020, during May, the height of the pandemic, the death rate went down. And then May 2021, 4 months after the injections were introduced, the death rate went up. So that's not a pandemic, at least not until there was the injections. But to a certain extent, I think I need to revise that, maybe even admit I was wrong, because now I'm coming to think that actually we are in a pandemic, a worldwide situation that's actually horrible. Now, I will point out that this situation I'm talking about has nothing to do with the virus. Oh, yeah. I wanted to say an example of when I was wrong, which a number of people have pointed out to me. A couple of years ago, I made the public comment, which I regret, that the virus that is associated with chickenpox, or at least they say is associated with chickenpox, has actually been found. I can now state unequivocally that I was incorrect. Now, the question obviously is, why did I make that mistake? Or maybe a better way to put it is, how did I make that mistake? And I have also said this over and over again. When I look back on all the many mistakes that I've made throughout my life and my career, pretty much everyone, if not actually everyone, has been because I believed the dominant narrative too much and didn't actually look into it myself. So what happened there is I assumed there, at least with chickenpox, there must be a virus that somebody has found. And then I saw pictures, you know, that were not associated with any particular study that said these were the chickenpox viruses. And I didn't look at the study, so I didn't know how they arrived at those pictures. I didn't know where those pictures came from. I didn't know if they were isolated from somebody with chickenpox in an actual isolation or some other way. Now, come to find out, and even admitted by the CDC, which gives no reference for any chickenpox virus being found in any human being or any lesion with chickenpox. They have no reference for that. That those pictures were actually not taken from chickenpox people. They were taken from cell cultures, and they were one of many different size and shaped particles, which they erroneously called viruses. And so I was fooled. And I was fooled for the same reason most of us get fooled, which is we didn't, or I didn't, look into it enough to actually convince myself what the truth of the matter was. And so I made a mistake, and now I have corrected that in my talk about Sam Bailey and her work, who specifically on chickenpox, and I just want to set that record straight. And the reason I'm saying that is in some ways is similar with the pandemic. So we're not talking about a pandemic that has anything to do with a virus, nor are we talking about a pandemic that has anything to do with any kind of sickness. But we are in a situation where a horrible situation, I'll use that word again, seems to be spreading and engulfing the whole world. And that's kind of a pandemic. So what is this situation? So actually the situation was very well dramatized if you watch an interview or a statement made by the NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers, who talked about the hoops that he had to go through when he informed or told his team that he wasn't getting this injection, and then he sort of misled the press. And so they did all these things to him, like they made him test every single day instead of every 2 weeks, like the so-called vaccinated people. They made him get a test and then sit in the car for an hour before the test results came in, whereas the vaccinated people had a test and then they could go right in, and on and on and on. So you get the impression very clearly that he was being shamed and humiliated and othered, and his life was being made miserable. Is exactly like what happens in a cult. These are the exact same techniques that all cults use. And the pandemic that we're having now could be summarized by people have chosen, and I use that word very deliberately, to do two things. A, not trust their experience to guide their thoughts and their actions. So for instance, if they see that nobody around them is dying, and that's their personal experience, they still don't believe it because they're being told something else which they have no personal experience of. And any human being who is convinced to not believe their or learn from or trust their own observation, their own experience, is in a very bad and desperate situation. And it's one of the prerequisites for essentially any cult member. The second part of this pandemic is people have stopped using information or observations similar to number one, but what I would call facts, to then guide their thinking. In other words, they have chosen, and again, I use that word very deliberately, to not think. Now, the interesting thing about that is one could argue that that is exactly what makes us human. There's other animals who can feel and act and respond, but we can see the world, experience the world, and then think about what we're seeing and integrate that into a new understanding of what we believe and how we want to act in our life. But that doesn't seem to be happening. So people have all these facts and all these direct observations, and yet, just like in a cult, they choose not to think about what the reality actually is. They simply believe what they're told. Now, the thing that worries me about this is that, as far as I can tell, and I have some experience of people I know being in cults, they all end up with death and destruction and sacrifice and sometimes even suicide. And that's what I'm worried about is happening here. We are essentially becoming part of a worldwide, almost pandemic-like cult situation, and we all know where those end up. Now, the reason I wanted to introduce this is because over the past week, I've had many, many people say to me that they have experienced people who are in the leadership role in the, say, anti-vax or fighting against the mandate community, who are not in line with what I and Stefan and Andy and Sam Bailey and others are saying about the fact that there's no virus. They've been to conferences, and all they hear is the virus, the virus, the virus, the engineered virus, the madmen who are making the engineered virus that's going to kill us all. And the virus is like the flu, and natural immunity is better than vaccine immunity, And pathogenic priming is a threat to all of us. And it's all about the virus. And sometimes even I get criticized for Tom, for instance, has a misconception. He misinterprets the science. So the problem with this is, or the other one that I hear is, well, this is not something we should involve in. Obviously, the people can't understand the science of whether there's a virus. So let's all just work together so that we try to get rid of these mandates, which I'm all for, not forcing people to do just about anything. And let's just put this aside. And simply put, I just cannot go down that road, because I think the only way to, quote, win this situation is to bury this virus idea, this virus misconception once and for all. Because if you don't, you end up having to turn off your thinking, stop understanding or trusting your evaluation of what you see, and you just believe the experts, you rejoin the cult, and that ends in death, destruction, sacrifice, and suicide. So what are they talking about? What do they mean when they say, poor Tom, he misinterprets the data. He misinterprets specifically what a viral culture means. Of course, they say, you can't find a virus directly from a living person. One has to do a culture. So let's go through this, because I know that people, even the people who've been listening to me for over a year, they get confused and they worry and they think maybe Tom is missing something. So let's go through this crucial step. What do they mean? So first of all, we all know that epidemiological observations, saying this person got it, San Quentin got it, this country got it, none of those prove the existence of a virus or that a virus has anything to do with any illness. If you haven't understood that, or if somebody says that's true, they are illogical, irrational, and making anti-scientific conclusions, essentially have decided not to think. So what about this observation? So it is a fact, not a theory. It is a fact that there is no paper that describes the finding, otherwise known as the isolation, of any pathogenic, i.e. disease-causing virus from any biological fluid of any human being ever. Not one paper. If I am wrong on that, send me the reference and I will, like I have in the past, correct my understanding. But as far as I can see, and everybody that I'm working with, that has not happened. By the way, we have now 135 different health institutions around the world that have acknowledged this in writing. We have the authors of the 6 papers who describe the isolation of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, who say they never found the virus, never isolated or purified the virus from any sick person. And we have a top virologist in the world saying, even if you mix the sputum of 10,000 people together, there is not enough virus in there to find it. You have to culture it. Now, here's the first question. So what do we mean by culture? We mean taking unpurified biological fluid like snot or bronchial alveolar lavage, mixing that with fetal calf serum, taking the nutrients away, adding antibiotics. We've all been through that. Mixing it with Vero cells or other cell cultures and seeing if the cells break down. And then once the cells break down, we say that's the virus. Now, here's what I want all these critics who say that Tom misinterprets this. So if the idea is that you, in order to find the virus, you have to grow it in some biological medium. That's what they're saying. Why isn't, if there's a virus, this is viral theory, and the virus comes in and infects your lungs, it uses your lung tissue as a biological cell culture. It reproduces itself millions of times, breaks down cytopathic effect on the lung cells, spews out a million different copies of itself. That is exactly what we're told is happening. Why isn't that a cell culture? Why do you have to not, why can't you find it? As we all agree, you cannot find it in that lung fluid. Why isn't that process exactly like a cell culture? Why do you have to take that fluid, which you cannot find the virus, and then put that on a special culture only of Vero cells, and then starve it and poison it, and then it breaks down, and only then will the culture show you a virus? That, my friends, makes no sense. That is irrational, illogical, and anybody who thinks that is talking anti-scientific nonsense. Now, besides that, we have proven without a doubt, which was proven also in 1954, that if you do this viral culture and you don't add anything from anybody who's sick, you get the results which are indistinguishable, or as Stefan said, identical. You see the identical cytopathic effect in the culture, whether you add something from anybody who's sick or not, whether you add anything that could possibly contain a virus or not, which means that the breakdown of the cells came from the experimental procedure, not from any infection, which then makes perfect sense of why you cannot find this virus in the lung fluid or snot or feces or urine of anybody who's sick, because it's not there, period. And if you can't see that, then it's because you've decided not to think. You just believe because that's what we're told. Personally, I don't like that. There is another bit of evidence, which I shared once, but I haven't emphasized this. And so let me see if I can bring this up. Okay, it's a simple quote. This is from the paper of the CDC, June 2020. Here's the reference by, I think she's a virologist, Jennifer Harcourt. This is what the CDC uses as their proof of the isolation of the virus. So I'm going to read it to you. Quote, SARS-CoV-2 showed robust nucleocapsid protein in both Vero cell types, less protein in HUH7.0 and 293 T cells, and minimal protein in A549 and EFK3B cells. Now, my guess is if most of the people hearing this will say something like, what the heck? Like, what is he talking about? And why is this essentially like the smoking gun here? Most people, my guess, is don't even know what this is talking about. But here's what it's talking about. So they decided to see what types of cell cultures they could grow this virus in. So they used the usual ones, which are monkey kidney cells, Vero cells. And then they took these two others, HUH7.0 and 293 T cells. I'm not sure exactly where those are from. And then two other cell cultures called A549 and EFK3B. These are different cell cultures, I believe, and somebody could check me. One was like lung cancer and some other lung and some other animal tissue. So they're different lung types. And what they found was that the protein composition, the nucleocapsid, in other words, the nucleus protein and the capsid, the capsule protein, are dramatically different depending on which cell line they grow it in. Let me say that again. The composition of this particle called SARS-CoV-2, in other words, the protein part of this particle, is dramatically different, dramatically, depending on what you grow the cells in. Now, the theory of living beings, including a virus, including bacteria, including monkeys, including kidney cells, including humans, is that we have a genome which makes the proteins that make up us. You cannot feed a kitten who makes certain proteins that makes up pumpkin, and you feed them tuna fish and they make certain proteins, and then you feed them chicken and they make dramatically different proteins like feathers and claws, and then you feed them a different kind of protein like spaghetti sauce, I don't know if that has protein, and you get a kitten that has wool and hoofs. That's not how it works. You may get very tiny differences in the protein composition of any being depending on what you feed it, but you can never get a dramatically different protein composition because the protein composition of the organism, in this case SARS-CoV-2, we are told is genetically determined by the genome of SARS-CoV-2. It is impossible for it to have dramatically different protein composition depending on what it's grown in, unless one thing is true. And that is, there is no SARS-CoV-2, and the protein composition could have only come because there is a different protein type in Vero cells, WHO cells, A549 cells. They are dramatically different. And so when they break down, obviously they will have a different protein composition. In other words, this proves that there is no SARS-CoV-2, that the particles they're finding are simply breakdown of the different types of tissue culture, exactly as you would expect if the reason for the breakdown is that you're starving and poisoning the tissue culture. I don't know how I can make that any more clear. There's a few other misconceptions I want to go over that came out during the last few weeks. People who say, oh yes, of course we know that viruses are pathogens. And by the way, there are 10 to the 43rd, I think was the quote, number of viruses in our viral genome. And oh, by the way, 46%, I'm not sure if that's the exact number, of our genome is actually viruses. Wow, that's pretty impressive. That's a big number, 10 to the 43rd. Where did they get that number from? And by the way, are you sure it's not 10 to the 42nd or 10 to the 41st or 10 to the 44th? Did somebody count 10 to the 43rd? You know how big a number that is? The answer is no. What they do is they see these little particles, which they mischaracterize as viruses. This is supposedly the new paradigm that we're all supposed to think about and maybe follow. So they count the number of particles. These are not viruses. These are breakdown of our own tissue. They count them in one square millimeter or nanometer. And then they say, well, you're a whole lot bigger than that. So there must be this number in your whole being. And where do they get this 43 or 46% of your genome is actually viruses? That is the heart of the deception. Why? Because the definition of virus in the old paradigm, this is not the new paradigm. In the old paradigm is we have genetic material. It breaks down inevitably whenever you're sick and even sometimes normally. And we have the misconception that the breakdown of the tissue is somehow called a virus. So as you break down and you start looking for particles, you say, wow, there's 43% of them match up with this thing we call a virus. None of them are viruses. That's just a misconception in the old paradigm, not understanding that these are breakdown of our own tissue. And eventually where this will lead is more and more viruses will be found because more and more breakdown products of our own RNA and DNA will be misidentified, mischaracterized as a new virus, to be made a new disease, to be made a new injection to prevent you from getting sick from this new imaginary virus, which in reality is only the breakdown of your own tissues. And that's the new paradigm. The final thing I want to say is one of these people who were critical of my understanding of the science gave a depiction of where this is going and what he wants to see happen. And I don't have the image in front of me, but you see what the back of two young girls who are walking away and they have signs over them. One says, I'm vaccinated and I believe in choice. And the other says, I'm unvaccinated and I believe in choice. So this is a wonderful image. We're all in this together, vaccinated or unvaccinated. We all believe in choice. We can all get along together. That is the image that this is trying to convey. But here's the problem. If you wanted to be realistic about it, you might actually show this picture. So the young girl on the left would be the unvaccinated, and the young girl on the right, I think it's a girl, that would be the vaccinated. Why? Because it turns out that this choice that we all should respect, and it's just a different way of looking at the world, will lead to millions and millions of people, including young children, being in the situation of this unfortunate young girl on the right. That image of the smiling, happy, walking away from you, freely discussing two young women, holding hands, I'm vaccinated, you're not, it's fine, we're all in this together, there's no big deal, let's just all get along. That is a make-believe world. We're talking about the injection increasingly more and more of some of the worst toxins, some of the worst harm-causing agents that have ever been exposed into human beings. There will be a kind of injury, which there already is, of millions of children and people. That world of, oh, it's just, we're all fine, that is not one of the choices. This is the choice. And I don't like this choice. I don't like this choice for the young girl on the right. Okay. I think that's all I have for right now. So with that little bit of a rant, let me get to the questions. Wondering if you might speak about hypothyroidism, the possibility of not taking pharmaceuticals. The only thing I want to say about that is I had a lot of success not ever using pharmaceutical thyroid, including Synthroid or Naturethroid or Armorthroid or any of those, but only if the person never took any of them. Once people started taking them, it became very difficult to get them off, for the simple reason that you are essentially telling your body that you don't need your thyroid anymore. So naturally it cooperates and stops making thyroid, and then you're a thyroid addict for life. Sometimes not, but that was a lot of my experience, especially if it would have been 20 years of taking thyroid. On the other hand, people who were newly diagnosed, and then you have to go through the process that I've described of what has happened to this person, with always asking the question, why did the body turn down your idol? And once you can answer that question, then you can understand what happened to the person, and the body will recover its idol, otherwise known as the thyroid, and you can live happily ever after. Have you added change suggestions written at the end of the chapters on adrenal insufficiency in your book, Fourfold Path to Healing, particularly about rashes, eczema? Thank you, Paul, you generously share. I mean, that book was written 25 years ago. So I did, when I occasionally look at it, not very much, it's been years, but I do think I was on the right track. That's maybe a little arrogant to say. But I was looking in the right places, and I got a lot of details incorrect. But so obviously, yes, I think much differently about that. And particularly this question, you know, rashes are your body's way of eliminating. It's the question to ask is always, why would my body make this pain happen? Why would my body make this rash happen? Why would my body stop me from breathing normally? Why would my body make this tumor? These are therapeutic responses. Once you see the wisdom of the body and can identify the strategy it was using, which is always unique in every case. So we're getting away from the concept of diseases and more into speaking about people's experience. That's why I'm so determined to bring the experience of life back into the world. We have been convinced that our experience is irrelevant, and we have to trust the experts, especially on things that we can't see or feel for ourselves, and we don't have any people to help guide us in the process. There's a question here that I won't read about vaccine shedding. And, you know, we've been over that. And I hear a lot of stories. And I think there's some possible explanations, but it's very hard to say right now how much of that is real. So this is a question about what do I know about vitamin D? Do you think that if you take D3 hormone, you inhibit your body to use light instead of making your own D3? I absolutely think that. And I would encourage everybody who's interested in this question, because the interview that I did with Alessio and Angelo, two Italian friends, Angelo wrote a 500-page, incredibly well-researched book on the dangers of taking vitamin D3 as a supplement. Basically, vitamin D3 is a kind of steroid hormone, similar to something like prednisone. And of course, if you take prednisone for poison ivy or eczema or asthma or rheumatoid arthritis, you will see immediate results. And then every possible bad situation to you will happen to you over time. So we have to be incredibly careful. That is a pharmaceutical intervention that should be relegated to the category of pharmaceutical drugs to be used when all else has failed. And there is no substituting vitamin D3 as supplements with being in the sun or using one of Alessio and Angelo's light boxes, which I have now over sitting in the corner there behind me. Do I think it's possible that we have been misled by science on purpose? It's possible. I don't want to get into that so much right now. It's probably a combination of a whole lot of things, including on purpose and including people just simply being confused in their thinking and not going through this. Everybody needs to ask themselves and get to the point where I am willing at this point in human beings' evolution and life process to say, I can't say what's true right now. I am going to be open to everything. And if somebody says, well, what about this? You just simply either one of two things. I'm not interested in that subject. Like, I'm not interested in carburetors. So I have no opinion about the matter and I don't want to learn about it. Or if you're interested, you do enough thinking, soul searching, pondering, praying, meditating, asking questions until you come to your own opinion, no matter what anybody says. That's the kind of people who are going to lead us out of this, no matter what anybody says, because most of what we're told through all kinds of mass, whatever, is simply irrational, illogical, anti-scientific nonsense. There's more questions here about vitamin D. It is not a good idea to supplement. The best is to be out in the sun or eat things like lard and cod liver oil and grass-fed butter. That's how normally human beings essentially had a steady supply of all the fat-soluble vitamins in the winter. I went over this in a previous podcast, previous webinar, about how to eat for the winter. And then if you're interested, check out the podcast I just did with Alessio and Angelo about their light box. You can see it over there in the corner because they graciously sent me one. And that is a way for 5 minutes a day to stimulate vitamin D production in a sort of natural way in the winter. I wonder if there are, in addition to physical consequences, any spiritual consequences to allowing our DNA to be modified, making us a little less, quote, human. So there's a couple things I want to say about this. First of all, it's clear that the attempt, by the way, I was going to say something about the criticism of me that this idea, it's not an idea, the observation and the fact that there is no SARS-CoV-2 virus is somehow irrelevant or not necessary. I just cannot see how the truth of uncovering the central misconception in this whole plot is somehow irrelevant to understanding the way out. To me, it is the only thing that matters. And I've come to understand that the people who typically say that the people will never understand this, we don't have time to teach them, they actually have no idea how to explain it or understand it themselves, which is why they don't explain it to anybody, because they don't know what they think or believe. And so obviously they can't explain it. This is the central issue. Once we clear this up, we see the delusion, we see the deception. We don't need to be in this cult anymore. We don't need to wear masks as a symbol of being in the cult. We don't need to socially isolate ourselves as all cults do to essentially break you down and to make it so that the central thing in making a cult work is you have to convince the people that if they get out of the cult, they will die. That their life and social interactions and communication, their very life depends on being an effective and valued and trusted and accepted member of the cult. Because they have nothing else. If you take the cult away, they are emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually disintegrated. So they will do everything, including give up their ability to think and trust their own experience, to not experience that psychological disintegration. And we all have to know that when we're dealing with friends and family members and critics, that they feel like they have to keep this going or they will be ostracized from their only support that they have. And that is a psychological, emotional, spiritual situation that they will not countenance. So they will fight you to the death. And that's what we have now. So is this making us less human? I think it's anytime you submit more and more to the cult, you become less human because you give up your ability to think. And there may even be factors in these injections that actually foster that because they interface with you in a way that makes your ability to think and feel and judge for yourself all that much more difficult. I don't have proof of that, but I have a feeling that may be the case. So let me skip down a little bit. I've heard that people who are vaccinated have a larger viral load than those who are unvaccinated. A viral load means they have more particles in their blood. And of course they have more particles in their blood because you injected them exactly with the sequence to attempt to make that particle and injected them with toxins so that they break down. And when our tissues and cells break down, we call those viruses, so that obviously there will be more of them if you inject people than if you don't. And that is why they find, they say, these the so-called vaccinated are more at risk for spreading the, in quote, infection than the unvaccinated. That is a misconception, because they cannot see that what happens when you're vaccinated is you break down. That's what we're calling a viral load. There's nothing spread. It's just obviously that's why that happens. And the reason the antibodies go up is because you've poisoned them, and we make antibodies to neutralize poisoning. There is a very simple, clear, rational, logical, factual, scientific way to understand all of these observations. This all makes sense. The other way doesn't. Do I have any suggestions for those struggling to maintain their oxygen levels, especially if they are hospitalized? I mean, I suppose that's a good question, but if you're hospitalized and doing all the things that are happening in the hospital, particularly being exposed to incredibly high levels of electromagnetic fields, you are in probably going to be in big trouble, as well as all the drugs and everything. I will point out, though, that there has been studies showing that the use of intravenous and possibly oral strophanthus / wabaine allows people to be more efficient in their utilization of oxygen than otherwise. And so that may be one way out, which obviously deserves more interest and study, but my guess is that won't happen. But frankly, anything you do to make the person's tissues more resistant and healthier, like vitamin C and C plasma and all the structured water, biogeometry devices to mitigate the EMFs, all of those will help you utilize oxygen more efficiently, which after all is the problem. It isn't that there isn't oxygen. It's that you either can't absorb it or you can't utilize it. And that's because you are being poisoned. So you stop the poisoning, help protect the tissues, and you should be able to use oxygen better. What is the best argument for the existence of a virus? The fact that everybody believes it. How did Stefan know he found a virus in the sea algae if there are no viruses? In the sea algae, there are little, what he calls mini spores, which were confused and called viruses at that time, but they're actually just the coalescence of the tissue as it attempts to protect itself, or even when it's doing well, it will form these little spores to help with its metabolism. The idea that they are so-called pathogenic viruses is not true. They should have a totally different name, which would be called a inclusion body or a little vesicle or a mini spore, which is now what he's calling it. Are flu tests also finding patterns of broken down cell matter and calling that the flu? The answer is yes. There are no tests for viruses. There only are tests for broken down cellular material. What supplements do I take? I have some from your website and confused about what they do. The best thing would be to talk to us about what they do. But the basic program, if you want to call it that, is I wouldn't say everybody, I don't want to be sort of selling supplements, but I think everybody will benefit from taking some sort of vitamin C to help protect your tissues, help with detoxification. Everybody will be helped by taking the plasma C minerals, which is the easiest most reliable way to get all the minerals you need in a vortex structured form. So I take those every day. I also use a lot of lemon in my water, partly because I like it and partly because I think it's actually helping. I take Strophanthus and have for 15 years, partly because people told me it would kill me if I took it every day. And I thought, well, 15 years, it still hasn't. And I don't seem to have any trouble. And I believe that it helps the utilization of oxygen and protect the tissues better. And I don't quite feel as good if I don't take it. So I keep taking it. That's the sort of basic, simple protocol, if you want to call it that, that I use, and then basically go from there depending on what's happening and how I feel and whether I feel anything else. I take a few drops of iodine in my morning water because iodine has a lot of good effects, and I put sea vegetables in my soup, so maybe I don't need to do it, but I do that. I take Shilajit, a little bit dab on the end of a little spoon thing. That's about it. Here's somebody who's offering an analogy about antibodies. The presence of antibodies in a person does not confer nor indicate immunity to an illness disease, but they are an artifact following an episode with that pathogen. There's no pathogen. Much like the presence of ash following a fire will not protect that house from future fires. Simply an artifact of the burning process. I like everything except pathogen. If you change that word to toxin, then that is a very good way of putting it. Would a Rife machine help take out the spike proteins in the vaxxed or maybe the unvaxxed? We don't know for sure that you actually make spike proteins. If you do, I have no idea whether a Rife machine would do that or not. It'd be interesting to find out, but I don't know that. The hypoxia symptoms are because there is a decreased bioavailability of oxygen, but more importantly, when you get poisoned in certain ways, you lose the ability to convert for your mitochondria, which use the oxygen to make ATP, which I've said a million times is not fuel, but helps structure your water. So anything that poisons your mitochondria, which includes metals and various toxins and not enough vitamin C and EMFs, etc., will make you more likely to be hypoxic. So anything you can do to avoid those or mitigate those, that's the sort of supplement strategy in food and earthing and all the rest of it. Hillman did not look at DNA that I know of. Is there anything they tell us about DNA is true? Not that I know of, but I'll keep looking. And the sauna space is a good way to expose yourself to light. I'm not sure right now the difference between the sauna space and the Alessio products. There is a difference because the sauna space is incandescent light and the Alessio products are not, but I'm not sure the technical difference. That's one of those questions that I would leave to an expert if I'm interested in finding out. All right. Thank you. Sorry for the rant, but there you go. Maybe I don't have to do this again. And thanks for joining me. And have a great week, and maybe I'll see some of you tomorrow.